Welcome to the Speech Uncensored podcast. I am Leanne. I'm your host. I'm a speech and language pathologist in the great state of Kansas, on the far right corner of the state in the city of Kansas City. So, we are doing a series for the podcast called The One Thing, where I get the opportunity to interview speech and language pathologists about their one thing. What is that topic that they are super passionate about that they want everyone else to know? It has been a very exciting series for me so far. I've really loved tapping into those very specific things that people have. And today I'm joined by Adria Thompson, and we're going to be talking about SLPs, ADLs, and dementia, and what role we play, what role we ought to be playing, and how we can be involved in those things. So welcome, Adria. It's good to have you.
Hi, thank you so much. I'm so excited to be here.
What made you pick SLPs, ADLs, and dementia as your one thing?
I'm super passionate about it, first of all. And if you know me, and if you're a speech therapist and you've had any interaction with me, we've had a conversation like this. I am just really passionate about serving our individuals with dementia with not only compassion, but efficiency, and to use all of our skills across, you know, our whole scope of practice to really benefit them. And so I'm really excited to dive into this topic. I know that some people might kind of raise their eyebrow when they see like SLP should be doing ADLs, but I welcome it. Let's talk about it.
Good. Yeah. And we're going to dive into that and unpack that, because me too, that's what got me excited about this episode. It's like, oh, okay. Well, tell me more. Like what are we doing with ADLs? You know, because it's very much the realm of our colleagues, like with occupational therapy and physical therapy. So we're going to touch on all of that in a minute. But first, let's get to know you a little bit better. So tell me a little bit more about you.
Yeah. So like you said, my name is Adria Thompson. I'm originally from Kentucky, but I'm currently living in Washington State right now. And I graduated with my master's degree in 2014 from Eastern Kentucky University. And for the past 8 years, I've been working in skilled nursing facilities, assisted livings, and like memory care facilities. And my husband and I have moved around a ton. So I've actually worked in like, I think 8 or 9 different facilities. So I've seen a wide variety of things across the country. So it's just been a really good perspective to have, seeing different, you know, types of people, different types of patients, but also working with different colleagues and seeing how everybody is serving the dementia population. So my specialty, of course, is dementia. And I just really came into that probably like 5 years ago. We'll talk a little bit about, you know, how that became my specialty, but I just really pursued a lot of continuing education in that area and just felt not only like passionate about it, but kind of realized I was kind of good at it. And so in the last year, when we moved out here to Washington, I started my own business, Be Like Care Consulting, and started just making content every single day for people who are caring for individuals with dementia. And, so that's kind of where I am now. I'm just serving professional and personal caregivers.
That's awesome. That's wonderful. Okay. So where shall we get started with our topic? Where are we diving in first in the role that SLPs play with ADLs and our people who are experiencing dementia?
So I think where this kind of all started and the foundation of why I started even getting into this is because I just really hate when therapists say that people with dementia are not appropriate for therapy, and not just speech therapists. I mean, I see this with PTs and OTs as well, but they'll say that, you know, people with dementia can't benefit from services because they're too progressed, because they can't follow directions, because maybe, you know, therapy doesn't feel skilled, or that there's no carryover. And those are more just descriptions of the disease rather than a reflection of our therapy. So I don't think that, you know, personally, I don't think those are reasons why someone can't benefit. It is a degenerative disease, yeah, and they're not going to get better. But we can serve them by improving their quality of life, their safety and independence. And so, you know, the professional and personal caregivers that are really on the front lines of caring for individuals with dementia are left with absolutely no training, no education. And, you know, even though like in skilled nursing facilities, a lot of times there's CNAs or certified nursing assistants, they still get very little training in how it looks to care for someone with dementia. And so when we as therapists who have tons of education experience, understanding of neurology and function and all of that, when we say that someone's not appropriate or that we're not going to provide therapy services to them, we're essentially saying like those caregivers can just figure it out. Like, good luck. And there have been research that has showed that individuals who care for people with Alzheimer's specifically are like, I think it's like 40% of caregivers die before the person they're caring for. And there's also a 63% higher mortality rate for caregivers than non-caregivers. So the stress that they are under and the physical and mental and emotional toll that caregiving is taking on them is insane. And I fully believe that we can kind of stand in that gap as therapists across the board to really help. And so, you know, I believe SLPs need to be working with individuals with dementia during ADLs, and not necessarily for the function of and the participation, the going through the motions of the ADL itself, but because there's so much communication that happens in the midst of that ADL. And that's really where we're going to land today is like, no, I'm not going to say that a speech therapist needs to go in and like, you know, provide training and using adaptive equipment and modifications for the actual task itself. But we need to be in the room when it's happening. We need to be seeing what kind of communication is happening from the caregivers and from the person with dementia and be advocates for them. There's so much communication breakdown. And a lot of times, you know, in the past, when I first started, and I'm like, I'm going to throw myself under the bus this whole time because I was an SLP when I first started that was always like, oh, I'm sorry. I'm the speech therapist. I don't do that. You know, when they're like, I need to go to the bathroom or I'm like, oh no, let me get an aide. Let me get the OT. That's not my job. And once I made the shift of kind of like not copping out like that and seeing how I can help in those moments, I started making such a bigger difference. So yeah, that's kind of where we're going to talk about communication during ADLs.
Okay, excellent. Yes, perfect. So tell me how you learned, how you really developed this skill. You've kind of touched on it like leading up to it, that there was definitely a time where you weren't all about this and you've developed it and grown this skill. So what was kind of that touch point for you that made that change occur?
I think that I can pull all this back to one patient and we'll call her Patty. But Patty was like, when I look back over the course of me being a speech therapist and my role in working with people with dementia, Patty just is the perfect example of really where that shift started happening. So I was working in a skilled nursing facility with a memory care unit. And I was working with this woman named Patty. She had just moved into the community and she was a global deterioration scale, probably like mid stage 5, moderate stages of dementia. And yeah, she just moved in. I'd been doing up until this point, a lot of workbook style, a lot of memory drill, a lot of very formal speech therapy with her. And, you know, this is also back during RUG level. So I was having to see her 5 times a week for at least 45 minutes. And it just got to the point where I just felt like, what the heck am I doing? Like, I'm not really making a difference. Every time I came back in to see her, she had absolutely no memory or carryover of anything we had done before. And so I was just kind of getting in this place with her of like, I don't know what my role is. And I loved her so much. Like, you know, we all have those patients that we just really click with and build a strong relationship with. And she was definitely that for me. And I just remember going into that memory care unit to see someone else and hearing Patty in the shower. And I thought she was like dying. I mean, she was screaming bloody murder. Like, I like opened the door thinking that she was going to be like, there was some disaster happening and she was just getting showered. and there were like two or three aides in there with her, and she was terrified, just screaming, kicking, hitting. And so, you know, they're like, oh, we got it under control. Like, this was no big deal. This happened all the time. And so I talked to the aides after, and they're just like, yeah, like, she's terrible to give a shower to. Like, it takes three people. She's just really combative. And it just did not sit right with me. And at that point, I didn't know, like, what my role was or, like, how I could work this into, like, a speech therapy session, quotation marks, you know, how I could really just make this a skilled service. I just loved Patty and hated what she was experiencing and wanted to help. And so I really started kind of like, I remember asking the aide, hey, you know, next time you give her a shower, can I help? And they were just kind of like, why? Like, you're a speech therapist. What are you going to do? And I was like, I don't know. I feel like I want to just see what's happening. Maybe I can help. And so every week during one of my sessions, I helped them shower her. And of course, at the time, I had no idea how to shower a person. I didn't necessarily have those skills. But I was just in the room and seeing how they weren't communicating with her. Like, you know, they were trying to give her verbal directions, but when she didn't respond automatically, they just physically were taking her shirt off. Like, they were just physically doing things to her that she wasn't having the time to process or understand. And I just realized this whole time, like, this is a communication issue. This has nothing to do with the actual showering of cleansing her body. That task was, yeah, it was getting done, but it was terrifying to her. And so I started just working my way into participating a little more and more each session, until I got to the point where I was the one that kind of approached her. I was the one that got her to the bathroom, that got her set up, that helped her understand what was going to happen. Then the aides would come in, we would work together. And when I say aides, I mean one, because it got to the point where, you know, that's how she started, where I described earlier, to fast forward to discharge. And she was a one-person shower with absolutely no combativeness, no like frustration, anger, fear. It was just, you know, it took a normal 15, 20 minute shower, and it made a huge, huge difference. And so Patty was really the turning point for me. I was like, whoa, I can use my skills in this moment to help her. So that's where it all started, I think.
That's awesome. That's such a great illustrative story that just really encapsulates, I feel like, everything that you're going to go into a lot more depth on. So let's talk about some of the barriers or limitations that we as speech language pathologists face when we want to bridge that gap, when we want to provide more functional quality of life therapy in the realm of addressing the communication that goes on in ADLs or activities of daily living.
Yeah, I don't think that, you know, speech therapists, like when I've talked to speech therapists about this, they're not like opposed to helping, you know, like we're not, I think it's easy to understand that, yeah, communication is an issue during ADLs. I think the problem and the pushback that I see is, number one, they don't feel like they have the skills. So, and I didn't feel like I did either. I don't know how to shower a person. And someone has commented on my videos before about showering, and they're like, what training did you get to shower someone? And I was just like, I shower myself. Like, I know how to cleanse someone's body. I don't know how to explain that. But the truth is, yeah, I mean, that involves transfers, right? It involves, you know, managing clothing, and safety is a big issue. And so that is definitely a understandable concern. We need to have the skills. And so there's a really great Asha Wire article written by Janet Brown that we'll have in the show notes. But it talks about how these, you know, should SLPs participate in transfers and things like that. And basically Ash's stance is that they call this basic patient care skills. So these are not skills that we have to have a certification for, that we have to have a degree for. These are just skills that anybody can learn. And, you know, I've worked in assisted livings for the last few years, and the aides, like the nurse aides there, they're not CNAs. They don't have any experience or background in caring for people. They get a training on day of orientation, and then they're sent off to do these tasks. So in the same way, like, we can be trained. And so I think it's really important that we have, like, that we're competent. And that's really where Asha's stance is that anything we do, we have to do with competence. And in that article, there's some references to our code of ethics and our scope of practice. And that's really where it lands. Like, we have to do things that we are confident and competent in. And so if we want to be competent, then we can just be trained as the staff is normally trained and trained by our colleagues, PTs and OTs. So I think skill is one issue. And then also there's this conversation about liability. And of course, I cannot speak to every care community in the country and every state. It's absolutely important that if you want to pursue this, that you have conversations with the care communities or the companies that you work for about what you need to do to be competent. But as long as we have done training, and Asha also recommends that it be demonstrated, that we demonstrate that competency and then it's in writing somewhere, and you can work that out with whatever company you work with. But as long as that's in place, then in general, liability shouldn't be an issue any more than it is for any other, any other professional. Another concern is that people say that maybe doing ADLs is not within our scope of practice. But as I've said before, we're not documenting ADLs. We're not documenting the level of physical assist that someone needs to wash their hair. We are documenting the communication that happens in that room. And that is absolutely within our scope of practice. There's another article by Natalie Douglas and Katie McDonald that we'll put in the show notes. And it's called Interprofessional Care and the Management of Alzheimer's Dementia, Leaving Our Silos. And it's a really great article just about this idea of interprofessional practice, of how we need to be involved in every aspect, that we need to be working. You know, as you said at the very beginning, like, ADLs are typically part of an OT's job, and nobody's arguing that. Like, absolutely, that's their expertise. But this shouldn't be a, is it my job or is it their job? It shouldn't be like, well, what am I going to do that the OT can't? It's more like, it should be more, how can my expertise as an SLP and their expertise as an OT combine to solve this problem? And in practice, when I have been participating in showers and dressing someone and grooming tasks and toileting, I'm not doing this on my own. If there's an issue in that realm, an OT is involved too. And so we either co-treat, like, at the same time and try to, like, figure it out together, or we just collaborate where we kind of touch base in between sessions and explain, hey, I noticed that this phrase works really well. Communication is in our scope of practice. That is not arguable. And OTs have ADLs in their scope of practice. That's not arguable. So we can work together. We can absolutely work together. So for anyone who kind of really feels concerned about, you know, doing ADLs or starting to participate, my recommendation is, you know, just to be in the room. Just to start with, be in the room, witness what's happening. You don't have to be the one hands-on providing care. You might work up to feeling more comfortable assisting with that. But if you're going to start, just be in the room, witness what's happening. And then also, it's okay to set boundaries. So personally, if someone is a max assist of one person, I'm not going to do that transfer by myself. I feel more comfortable providing min assist, contact guard assist physically for these tasks. And if I feel like someone might have a behavior or a physical need that is outside my realm of participating and, like, assisting on my own, I'm going to have another person in there with me. So it's not all or nothing. Like, we can set boundaries and we can, you know, figure out how we can help, you know, without 100% doing the task ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Good. I appreciate that. I feel like you really delved into each of the areas, that we typically come up against and really defined kind of what what the limitations are and how we can work within them to be successful as the expert in communication and facilitating this for an improvement on the person's quality of life. I feel like this would also has a side benefit of improving like the working environment for all the people there. Like how much must a person not look forward to having to shower someone every day where it takes 2 to 3 people and they're like screaming and kicking the whole time. Like that's not fun for anybody there, especially the individual who is feeling that level of angst. So it is so incredible, like this amazing power we have to like alter that entire situation.
Absolutely. The level of trust that I also like doing that builds with the staff is that they see that I am always willing to help, that I'm willing to jump in, that I don't have these like, oh, I can help with that, but not with that. And I think that, you know, it's a super great, it's great for rapport building with the caregivers. But also it's just really like, you know, I think some people also like have a concern about productivity. It also improves our productivity because we're not having to stop our sessions to allow someone to go to the bathroom and like, you know, in that 5-minute time scurry to try to find something else to do that might be productive. Like there's so many benefits of more that goes outside of even just, you know, helping the situation.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. So I want to look back into the past and I want you to tell me how your practice would have been different if you began this transition sooner.
Yeah, I think that my sessions would have been far more functional from the get-go. And, you know, functional in the sense that I would be doing things that matter and that really make a difference for the day-to-day care for someone with dementia. Early on, like I said, we would sit down, do drill, do all these, you know, more traditional structured tasks. And I just felt like I wasn't really helping out much. I've really started, and I think that that really reflects too in the way that I communicate with caregivers. Back in the day, I would talk to caregivers and I would say, hi, my name's Adria. I'm a speech therapist. I help people with speech, language, communication, swallowing, with thinking skills and memory. Is there anything that Mary needs, you know, in that realm? How can I help her? And I would kind of put the weight of figuring out what I was going to be doing during my sessions on the caregiver. They had to process all that information and think about Mary and think, okay, well, what would fit in that category? And now I say, what's hard in caring for Mary? And I just allow them to tell me what the functional things are that are difficult in caring for her. And then it's up to me to tease out where is my role in that. We don't need to be putting that pressure on caregivers' shoulders of like, figure out what my goals and my plan of care and my interventions are going to be. We just say what's hard in caring for them. And if they say toileting, I'm not going to be like, oh, no, that's not something I do. I'm going to be like, okay, great. And observe what it looks like to toilet because maybe it's a communication issue. And so I think had I tapped into that early on, my sessions would have been far more functional because showering, for example, is far more than washing someone's body, right? It's getting them up out of bed and sitting on the edge. It's then them walking across the room, them going into the bathroom, sitting on the shower bench, taking off their clothes. All of that are like, they have to follow directions. They have to understand what we want them to do. And so we need to break, you know, I now realize we need to break those things down into much smaller pieces and find compliance in how communication will get us to the very next little step, not just about washing their body head to toe. The hardest part typically is just getting them started. Once they're in the shower, typically they love it. So all that in between or like, you know, before stuff too is like, it's where we can shine. And I think if I had started this earlier, I also would have given myself much more credit for my skilled services. I think a lot of times we take for granted the level of skill we have just in conversation and getting someone to follow directions. We know just instinctively to get down on their level, to get eye contact, to speak slowly, to do all these like communication strategies that are so much a part of being a speech therapist. And we think that that is what everyone is doing. And that's not a skilled service. And oh my gosh, that is a skilled service. And, you know, earlier when I said that I was talking about Patty, I actually had a CODA go to my director of rehab and say, you know, Adria is out of her lane. She's showering people. She's duplicating services. Like, what is she doing in there? You know? And then I also had just recently, actually, this was a CODA also, not, you know, no offense to CODAs. It just happened that these are the two people that kind of got onto me. But one time I was helping a man just last month, he had dementia and he was just super ornery. Nobody could get him to do anything. Just old style of like, you know, that cranky old man. That's exactly how we could describe him, but he wouldn't do anything. He would not get out of bed. He was just wasting away. And so I got him, you know, the idea was eventually we'd get him to the shower, but in my sessions, I'm like, we're not going to go from 0 to 100. I'm going to get him up on the side of the bed. Or then I'm going to get him to sit in a chair outside of his bed so we can actually change the sheets for once. And so one day I got him finally to sit in a chair and I got him to agree to trim his beard. And so I was trimming his beard for him. You know, I asked him if he would do it and he said no. So I'm helping him trim his beard. And the CODA walked by and she was like, oh, you got him, like, you're trimming his beard? And I was like, yeah. And later in the session, like after the session, she said, you know, if you got him to do that himself, it would have been skilled. And I was like, I see what she's saying. I see where she, like, why she said that. Because, you know, typically, okay, a skilled service is for them to be more independent, right? But my response was, has anyone got him to do that? Has anyone been able to get him to agree to be shaved? And have you got him to do that? You know, has anyone in this building? And the answer is no. So if we're doing something that nobody else can have done, then I would argue that it's a skilled service. So I think being more functional and giving myself credit for what's skilled would have really helped me in my career, you know, even especially early on.
I agree. I've definitely in my own practice run up against feeling like what is skilled, what is not skilled, feeling boxed into a corner. And when we really open up and identify what communication is and what it can unlock and how that is such a skilled service, because we take it for granted and we think, well, not everyone, that's a very gross generalization. Otherwise we would not have a job. Like, everyone can communicate. So like what you were describing earlier about how we as speech and language pathologists know, like, to get down at eye level, to chunk information into smaller manageable parts, to take pauses so that they can process. Like, these are things like I take for granted that I assume all the other professionals working in this sphere know and also do instinctively or with very minimal training, but it's not. And that is skilled. And when we take the time to demonstrate and to educate and share that, that's a skilled service. Just like what you said, when something can't be done by another carer, but you can get it done, that's skilled service. That's literally, I feel like, how they define skilled service. If exactly. Somebody without the credentials can do that exact same thing, then it's not skilled. And honestly, lots of people providing that home carer function are showering people. So then our OTs out of a job. Like, mm-hmm. No.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah. So it's a whole thing, but unpacking and redefining what is skilled versus not, and our role and our fluidity in that is really like career changing.
Absolutely. Yeah. We need to give ourselves credit. We're doing it anyway. And we're saying, oh, like, this doesn't feel skilled. Well, like, I don't know what it feels like to you, but that's our job. And it's just that you're good at it. That's why it feels so normal.
Mm-hmm. Ooh, that's fun. Let's let that sink in for a little bit. You just happen to be really good at it. So it doesn't feel skilled because you can do it. And you think it has to be hard. Like, a skilled service has to like be super hard and really draining. And that's not the case, because you went to graduate school for this. You suffered for this.
Exactly.
Oh man, I love that. That's a fun diversion that we just walked into. Okay. So my next question is, how do you put this one thing into practice now? I've really loved your illustrations to date. How else can you unpack really being the communication facilitator throughout ADLs?
Yeah, I'll give you some more examples because I think that's really what helps therapists see where our role could be. I know I've talked a lot about showering, but let's talk about grooming. I had a woman, we'll call her Lois, and she was very highly anxious. She's a little chihuahua sometimes, you know, like always just nervous and shaking. And she had very limited verbal expression skills. She would talk, but it was always very halting, and not always, you know, sensical, not a lot of content that we could use. So I realized that there were some days and with some caregivers that she was far more subdued and calm than others. And, you know, the ones where the days that she was not very calm, the aides would say, oh, she is just, it's terrible getting her up in the morning. She is wild, like getting her ready. She gets so angry and upset. And so I just was like, okay, let me see it for myself. And I got her up in the morning. We started getting her ready. And knowing what I know about her, and I think this is also maybe something I can talk about real quick, but you know, we need to get to know these people really well and understand their conversation abilities, their communication skills, their limitations, their ability to follow directions. We can understand that and we can get our, you know, wrap our minds around that in those more structured speech therapy tasks. That's okay if we have sessions about that, because what I knew from her, from our more traditional speech therapy sessions, maybe not workbooks, I don't use workbooks, but you know, I took that information to know what to expect from her during grooming. So basically, I found out that she has very particular interests and routines in the morning. And I also got this information from her family. It's important we talk to family. But she, if she had her way and had all of the routine that she had, which I can remember it to this day, she had a particular face wash that she wanted to use. She had these balms and lotions and like, she's a real fancy lady. She put all those on. She would brush her teeth and it would literally have like a tablespoon of toothpaste. Like you couldn't even see the brush anymore. It was disgusting. But she was insistent that that's how much she wanted. Then she would use mouthwash and then she would put on her lipstick. And if she did not have that routine, then her day was wild. Like, if you tried to get her out of the bathroom, if you forgot one of those steps, she would put her hands up on the door frame and like she was in a wheelchair and would like refuse to leave the room. And so knowing what I know about her and her inability to verbally communicate that and her inability to remember those steps, even if she could communicate, I developed basically a visual schedule that I put up on the, you know, taped up on the mirror that had all the steps of things that she liked and the order she liked it in. And it helped her know what came next, but it also helped the staff know how to get her ready and allow her at the end of all of that to be calm. So that's one way, knowing what we know about her communication abilities, how we can kind of stand in that gap and advocate for her. Another one, I love this story. I've told it on my channel before, but, we'll call this lady Jane. But she came to our care community. She was in a locked memory care unit. And for the first week, all the staff were saying that she was impossible to toilet. They could not get her to sit down. She would say she had to go to the bathroom. And she had some, she also had some verbal expression issues. You know, not able to just say, hey, like, here's my problem. She would go into the bathroom, pull down her pants, be all about it. Then you go to sit her down and she was stiff as a board and would scream and say no. And so then, you know, of course I took it upon myself to see that myself. I went in and worked with her. And it was probably the second or third time that I toileted her where I heard her say icky, like just this little word. And I was like, it just came to me all of a sudden. I was like, oh my gosh, what's a reason why I wouldn't sit down on the toilet? Because it's disgusting, right? Like if you go to a porta potty or you're in a public public area and you go to the public restroom and you're like, oh my gosh, I'm not sitting. She was a hoverer like her whole life. When she'd go to public, she would hover over the seat and pee. And so she thought the toilet seat was gross, even though it wasn't. Maybe she had Lewy body dementia, so maybe there was a visual hallucination involved. But I just had this idea. Like, I got a wet wipe, cleaned the seat. She sat right down, like, immediately, no problem. And just so, once again, understanding her limitations in communication and taking nonverbal and even just that one little verbal, that word of icky, it just made it make sense to me. This is why she's not sitting down. And once I trained the staff with that, then that's all they had to do. And over time, that toilet, which it was in her apartment, it was hers. No one else was using it, but she didn't know that. To her, this is a public restroom. She's never been here before. And so over time, they could ease off doing that because it felt more familiar to her and she didn't think it was a public restroom. And I remember telling her daughter and she was like, well, she never did that at home. And I was like, well, do you hover over your toilet seat at home? Like, she wouldn't do that at home. So it was just a really cool moment of like figuring that out. And then I'll give one more about showering. We'll call this woman Mary. And she would shower. She would agree to shower. But when she was in the shower, she would be in there for like 2 hours. She had Alzheimer's disease. And when I say short-term memory, I mean like short-term memory of like 15 seconds, 20 seconds maybe. And so she was repetitively washing the same parts of her body over and over and over again because she didn't know that she already had. And so the staff, of course, were just, she needed physical assistance to get in and out. So they had to be there. But they were just like, she wasn't getting showers because no one wanted to spend that time to get her, fight the battle of convincing her that she had already washed her hair 12 times. She was also like rubbing her skin so hard that it was like her skin was like peeling up. And then she thought it was dirt. And so then she would want to wash her body again. It was just this terrible cycle. And so I was like, okay, let me see. So I went in there with her and I just, you know, once again, having the idea of like a visual schedule, I got a whiteboard marker and wrote on the tile of the shower, all the parts of her body, hair, face, neck, shoulder, arms, stomach, you know, on and on. And I would say, okay, Mary, look up here. We're going to, I get really distracted and I forget things a lot. So I wrote down all the parts of the body that you need to wash. And we just want to make sure, I want to make sure you thoroughly wash everything, right? We're speaking her language. She loves to be thoroughly washed and I don't make it her fault. You're forgetful. So we're going to write this. It's, oh, I get really distracted. So I'm going to write this. And we would go through and when she inevitably asked to wash her hair again, I would say, oh, look up here. We've already checked it off. And we would just go through and check every single part of her body after we washed it. And also I would remove everything from her shower and so that she didn't have access to it. So if she wanted to wash her hair or if she needed more soap for a part of her body that we've already washed, I controlled that. And we got showers down with her to 20 minutes. And that was life-changing for the caregivers, decreased the burden of care for them. But it took what I know about her communication and her cognitive abilities and her ability to read and all of that to develop an intervention that was really helpful for her. So those are just a few examples of like how we as speech therapists can really make a difference and just be creative and try things, try all kinds of things. A lot of things won't work. And that's okay. But when you do find one that does work, it can be, you know, it can be all the difference.
That's so true. And I'm a big fan of experimentation. And I talk specifically about that with my patients. I'm like, we're going to try lots of different things. We're going to find what works, what doesn't. Like, I want you to experiment with these strategies that I give you, with these tools, like try them out. It may not work at first. You may hate it. We can throw it out or we may cycle back to it and like try it another day. Like, it's just about being open to possibilities. Like, that's the first step. So I really like that you've not really emphasized, but it's been a part of your journey too, to do that experimentation, to be open to to play the detective, to find out like what's not working, how can communication facilitate these things? And then once you do and you find it, like, boom, there it is, like achievement unlocked. That's really cool.
Absolutely. And I think too, it's really important when we do try a bunch of things out, but that we don't train caregivers until we find what works. Because I find this a lot in the dementia world from therapists, where we know these general strategies about communication and these ideas. And even if you might, you know, you hear one of these ideas and you think, oh, that would work really well, don't train staff or train caregivers that this is what we need to do until you try it yourself and see that it works. Because I think a lot of times I've seen therapists have these great ideas and then go to staff and say, okay, this is what we're going to do. This is going to work. We're going to wipe the toilet seat every time. And then the caregivers are like, okay, awesome. And then they go in there and it doesn't work. And they're like, that just crumbles your rapport with them. I mean, it destroys it. So I always encourage any therapist, especially SLPs, to try things a couple of times and make sure that it works in different scenarios, different times of the day, on different days, before we bring this to these caregivers, especially, you know, when we're talking about like in the skilled nursing facility that have so much on their plate already. We don't want them to be running around trying a bunch of things if we don't even know if they're going to work ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Well, Adria, this has been wonderful. I've really enjoyed this talk. Thank you so much for bringing all of these really clear examples of how to put this into practice. It's not just an idea, a concept, but it's something that you've been working on and implementing and seeing the benefits of. So thanks so much. Is there anything else that you wanted to touch on or cover before we wrap up?
No, I think we've covered it all. I just really want to encourage listeners, if you're a speech therapist, to just try it and don't feel like you have to, you know, jump in on every single person on your caseload and shower everybody. Just pick one person that you really think you might be able to make a difference in and just try. Just throw yourself out there and see what happens. I think you'll surprise yourself how many skills you have that can be beneficial.
That's awesome. All right. Now, if people want to learn more about this concept and how to put it into practice, how can they reach out to you and learn more?
Yeah. So I have Instagram, TikTok, and Facebook at Be Like Care. And I post either a post or a video every single day about different tips and tricks for caring for individuals with dementia. You can always reach out to me also via email, info@belikecare.com. And then on my website, belikecare.com, I do SLP consultations. So if anyone wants to kind of sit down and talk with me at length and talk about a specific patient or how, you know, how to build up your confidence in this area, I'd love to talk to people. So, yeah.
Awesome. All right. And those resources that you mentioned and you touched on in our chat today will be in the show notes on speechuncensored.com. So y'all can access those and nourish and flourish and be awesome. So thanks, everyone.
Thank you.